Welcome. This is the U.S. EPA Green Remediation webinar entitled Your Role in Green Remediation, Implementation, and Case Studies in Green Remediation, This Year's Models and Tools. This is the last session of a three-part session that's been hosted by U.S. EPA. We ask that during this webinar, if you could please put your phones on mute during the seminar. It will minimize the amount of disruption and background noise that the other participants will hear. If you don't have a mute button, press star 6 to mute. Press pound 6 to unmute your lines at any time. Also, please do not put this call on hold, as this may bring delightful but unwanted background music over the lines and internet interrupt the seminar. You should note that throughout the seminar, we will ask for your feedback. If you don't want to wait for a Q&A break, which there will be two during the session, one after the policy section and later on during the case study section, we ask you to submit those via web. If you notice at the top of the slides, there's one slide that, one button that will allow you to submit questions and report any technical difficulties during the webinar, and that is a circle with a question mark on it. You can move back, move forward, and backward in the slides by using the single arrow buttons. Left moves you back one slide, right advances you one slide. The doubled arrow buttons will take you one to the first slide and the last slides respectively. You may also advance to any slide using the numbered links that appear at, on the left side of your screen. The button with the house icon will take you back to the main menu, which displays our agenda, speaker information, links to slides, and additional resources. Lastly, the button with a computer disk can be used to download and save today's presentation materials. So with that, if you could move to slide number 3. And in today's seminar, we'll cover a few topics. First, I provide this webinar is based off of a NARPM series, or a National Association of Remedial Project Managers session that was held in 2010, and we've asked the speakers to come back to provide their presentations for this current webinar. And with that, I'm going to go with the first speaker, who is Kirby Biggs at U.S. EPA headquarters, and his talk is entitled Environmental Results Through Environmental Council of the States. And Kirby, with that, take it to you.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much. If you downloaded my presentation, there may be some animation in it. So, you know, please just click through the flying in symbols and things like that, and accept my apologies because I was experimenting with the animation, and I hadn't planned to put it in this one. So if you're on slide 7, you'll see that my name is Kirby Biggs. I'm with the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, one of the divisions of the Superfund office. I'm in the headquarters component. Several of our jobs are to provide optimization technical support. Also, we are the ones who run this Clue-In website, and we are also heavily involved in the ITRC, and I'm the project officer for that. If you'll go to slide 8, this is a hazardous waste research cooperative agreement, and it supports the achievement of EPA's strategic plan, Goal 3, Objective 3.2, which is the restore land. And it also helped implement the 311B mandated CERCLA Innovative and Alternative Technology Development and Demonstration Program. And this is one of the ways that we get the states. It was awarded non-competitively for the first round, which was 2001 through 2006. And then also in the 2007 through 2011 round, it was also awarded a co-regulator exception. Of course, that one's no longer available. It's coming up for renewal, and we're figuring out what to do now. if you'll turn to slide 9, you'll see that our objectives are, first of all, that we've managed this since 2001, so it's been quite a while, and we've gotten a lot of products, as you'll see later on. We're trying to foster interstate collaborations to promote awareness and technical understanding of alternative innovative technologies and how they are placed into use. And this cooperative agreement produces information that states use because it's by states for states. That's the public purpose of stimulation that we are trying to get to with this ITRC, ECOS ITRC cooperative agreement. That's the Environmental Council of the States. I hope people are familiar with that organization. That's the commissioner level association that helps to provide information to the states. And we are also increasing federal and state coordination of technical and regulatory issues in developing and evaluating and implementing alternative technologies and placing them out into the world. On slide 10, just a quick look at the funding structure of this cooperative agreement. It was for a three-year period, for five-year period for $3 million. So far we put about 1.8. Looks like we're going to end up coming up with about a total of 2.1 for the five-year period. Many, many offices contribute to this. Every year I go and pass the hat and work with all of these organizations, either collectively or individually, to develop a funding strategy for that. Usually runs to about $300,000 a year. The great news is that we can actually accept a variety of different money, both T, that's the Superfund, C, which is the research money, and EPM, which is just regular money that we use for developing environmental management strategies. On slide 11, what exactly does this project do? Well, there's funding from EPA, DOD, and DOE. We put in about $300,000 a year, and we let them use the Clu-In website as an in-kind service. That Clu-In website costs us quite a chunk. DOD puts in about $800,000 a year, DOE about $1 million. So we're kind of, in terms of the money itself, actual cash money, we are a smaller player, but of course we also supply about 50 people's time who serve on these teams, and as you see, we spend a lot of time on that. The teams evaluate innovative or alternative treatment and characterization technologies for hazardous waste site remediation. For example, there might be phytoremediation or in-situ oxidation, PRVs, optimization, triad, various other strategies, methodologies, chemicals and technologies. They prepare and disseminate technical and regulatory analyses and guidance. Those are both overview and tech regs, as we'll see in a short time. And then those are converted into internet-based trainings, which are offered free at EPA's Clu-In.org website. That's the one we're on right now. And all of those trainings, if you are interested in them, are archived in the Clu-In archive, and you can get to them. Also, they develop and deliver classroom training on that same guidance. And that classroom training, for example, one of them is going on right now, two of them are going on, is vapor intrusion, which is being widely attended by states and EPA, it being, of course, a key interest area for all of us these days. And also another one on light non-aqueous phase liquids, LNAPLs, and how do you clean those up. If you move to slide 12, what is this ITRC composed of? Well, in 2010, the ITRC membership totaled around 500. That would include consulting firms, oil and gas companies, and state members and local members and academia and just a very wide spectrum of both government, private, public, and localities. About 200 state and local environmental agency members themselves, from all the states except for Louisiana, Idaho, Montana, and D.C. The first three there are having lots of budget problems. District of Columbia has a very, very small number of hazardous waste sites and does not participate. There's also a very youthful network of 50 state points of contact for each of the states. Of course, actually, in this case, it would be 46, but that review the documents, and they obtain state concurrence on these documents. And they also assist in deploying the technologies and techniques at site cleanups. Another key function that they perform is reviewing and assembling high-priority issues in their state, and that is compiled to help inform the selection of the teams, because in the three-year cycle, the teams come and go as they finish their projects for each fiscal year, and each fiscal year new ones are selected based largely on these state, federal, and other priorities. There's an industry affiliates program that industries can join that incorporates the private sector, and that would be industry consulting firms and contractors to many different areas of environmental cleanup. And each team also includes community and tribal stakeholders, so the public has their way into the process. On slide 13, you can take a quick look at the deliverables that have been produced over the course of the last 10 years, let's say, or so. That's so by the end of 2010, ITRC produced 49 tech reg documents, 35 technology overviews. That's what one of the things we'll be talking about a little bit later in this presentation, the Green and Sustainable Remediation Overview, and the tech reg that will succeed it. And they produced 14 case study compilations with state issue surveys, summaries as a resource guide. There have been a total of 41 teams that have passed through the three-year project life cycle, and currently 12 teams are active. We'll take a look at those in just a few minutes. There are 51 internet-based training courses. Many of them are available through ClueIn, but all of them are available through the website at itrcweb.org. And you can access those, download them, and play them for yourself if you want to, you know, construct a training program for yourself. It'd be very easy to do in almost any area. So far, the internet-based training has reached a total of around 66,000 people and about 180,000 total training hours. And there have been 9 multi-day classroom trainings, and I mentioned the LMAPL training, and about 4,100 people have participated in those trainings. On slide 14, we notice the 2010-2011 ITRC teams. That is over the course of the next 2 years. That we've got environmental molecular diagnostics, biofuels, and I've got the closing date for each of those. The GSR team that we'll be talking about in a few minutes, in situ stabilization, DNAPL site strategies, incremental sampling. That's going to be a big one for everybody. Contaminated sediments, permeable reactive barriers, a very useful and widely used technology these days. Mining waste, a very nice model selection capability in this to look at. If you've got a mining site, where can you take, as you burrow down through, it will eventually deliver you to a potential set of technologies that might be applied at your site, given the site conditions. And then the natural attenuation of metals and radionuclides, that's already finished, and that has been printed and produced. And the internet-based training is in developmental progress now. There have been a lot of munitions projects because, of course, DoD is involved, and the USO White Area Assessment is closing again in 2010. And there's remediation risk management. That's going to be closing as well in 2010, and we are currently working with ITRC on that particular issue. In 2010, the products that we expected, and I believe we got, well, almost, because the RRM document, you see at number 3, and the Green and Sustainable Overview document did not quite get finished in 2010, but they are right on track for early production here in 2011. ITRC operates, by the way, on a calendar year basis. There's mass flux, mining cleanup, natural attenuation, and the LNAP classroom training is actually going on already. If you move to slide 16, you'll notice that the 2011 expected products are PRVs, ISS, the incremental sampling methodology, which we're working on hard on that, integrated DNAPL, biofuels, and the overview document and the tech reg document are expected in this year. And then environmental molecular diagnostics overview, an agreement was made that an overview document may be necessary for that because EMV is really a pretty new topic area, and it needs some initial introduction, I think, in order to get people familiar with that concept. On slide 17, I just wanted to put down what I thought were the short and long-term environmental results, because people are always asking me, like, well, what does this actually do for us, although it's pretty obvious once you start finding out. First of all, I think the ITRC products increase knowledge and expertise by helping both, well, not only state and local, but also federal personnel understand the advantages and limitations of the various technologies, hazardous substances are handled, the treatment procedures involved in those, and various approaches to regulatory issues that might be faced in deploying those, and how to potentially overcome those. It promotes the adoption of best management practices by clearly describing the characteristics, use and deployment of the technologies, and crafting advanced methods and approaches to site cleanup, investigation, and other site remediation areas. And it helps to establish unproven but available cleanup technologies and to try to validate and verify those. There are a lot of other efforts that go along with this, the Environmental Technology Verification Program, and many others, which we'll look briefly at a little bit later in the slides. But this group really does a good job at putting that together. On slide 18, the long-term environmental results, I think, are that emerging or optimized remedies and techniques, they can really substantially reduce the cost, resource use, energy requirements, and now, as we are collectively working at it, the greenhouse gas footprint of site cleanup activities. And the other great thing about this is that it creates a lot greater certainty when you're trying to select a remedial action and selecting a more effective remedial action that could potentially result in increased protection of public health and the environment. And another good thing about this that some people don't think of often, but since we do work with DOE and DOD very closely on these, including all the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Corps of Engineers, it's a way for all of us to promote harmony and consistency within our programs, along with things like the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable and other venues. But this one, you work hands-on, side-by-side, shoulder-to-shoulder with experts in the other federal agencies, and it's a great way of understanding each other's issues and problems. On 19, let's move on now to the Green and Sustainable Remediation Team of ITRC. First of all, I think this slide's a little old, a little dated, because it said no nationwide guidance, but I think that there is still little nationwide guidance on how to best incorporate green and sustainable remediation into a regulated cleanup process, and we are all working on that very rapidly. I think most of the regions now have their own green remediation policy, so that this first bullet might be a little bit dated, because I think that the guidance is emerging. However, the area is still quite confusing, and since it is quite nascent, we are still feeling our way to a large extent. And I think this particular document is really going to help people understand, starting off with the overview, will really help people understand what the lay of the land is currently, and with all the federal agencies, and it's going to compile in one spot a succinct summary that one can look at to kind of catch, you know, where do we stand with this. There is definitely an increased need for an even identification of sustainability metrics and life cycle analysis. LCA is now really an up-and-coming thing because it's very difficult to ascertain your green remediation footprint unless you can understand what the life cycle costs of your materials and labor and energy use might be. It's a good way, an excellent way, really, to communicate best practices to state regulators and environmental consultants, because these are widely available. And an internet training will be coming out of this that will help people in the both consulting industry, state localities, academia, to understand where things are and how to do this green remediation. On slide 20, the goal of the team is to provide documents and training that educate state regulators and other environmental professionals on how to appropriately incorporate sustainability and green technologies into the cleanup process. And there is a difference of opinion and need with respect to CERCLA and non-CERCLA cleanups. And we have all been debating the three legs of sustainability, the environment, the social, and the economic legs, and how those can best be incorporated in CERCLA cleanups, most specifically, into the NCP and the nine criteria. Not incorporated in NCP, but rather how can we use the nine criteria and incorporate green and sustainable cleanups into that. The economic and the social component of this is a difficult nut to crack because CERCLA doesn't necessarily recognize things like, for example, intergenerational equity. On slide 21, the leadership of this team, Tom O'Neill, New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, has headed several teams, a number of teams within ITRC. Very good program manager, and Rebecca Burden, a Minnesota Pollution Control Agency petroleum remediation program member, is the co-chair. 15 states have committed team members. We participate headquarters as well as several regions on this, including one of our speakers coming up, Brad. Team membership commitments from major industry organizations, DOD, DOE, DOI, and citizens, academic, and tribal stakeholders, all of whom participate and have been participating. There have been over 100 people on this team, and so that just tells you what kind of interest is generated. On slide 22, we're looking now at, well, how do you do this thing? You know, what metrics are the most useful? What is the sensitivity of those, and which ones have the greatest impact? What is a consistent and appropriate way of interpreting the metrics? Once you have a metric, you know, how do you interpret it? Are there definitions around it? Do people understand precisely what the metric is and what it tries to capture? And then how can we minimize the overall risk to human health and the environment by applying sound GSR practices? That's, again, the holistic look at the site, looking at the site conceptual model, looking at the exit strategy and the end game for the site, and how green and sustainable remediation can be used to reduce the overall footprint throughout the process.
Kirby, just to let you know, you've got a minute left.
A minute? Oh, my goodness. Okay.
No. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Where am I here? I'm on 22. Let's go to 23. The summary of the approach on the left side is the process of green remediation. In the middle, it's the development of the best management practices. And then on the right-hand side, it's applying those to the each of the component pieces of the process. Turning to the next slide, slide number 24, the schedule, 2010, the overview, 2011, the tech reg document, 2012, the training modules on slide 25. There are many other different related activities going on. I think many of you are familiar with these. If we look at slide 26, we'll see that the highlights of the overview document, it's finalized now, that has definitions and boundaries. It shows different related efforts, some considerations, the greening of traditional technologies, a number of tools that can be used, contact lists for the states, and federal and other programs. On slide 27, a quick look at the highlights of the TechReg document. This is the TechReg, the first one we talked about just a second ago. The previous slide was the overview document. This is a much larger document. It's going to talk about the concurrent process and training, and it's going to stress practicality, that is, useful definitions, tools, and case studies. On slide 28, the outline is going to be have an introduction with a problem statement, including some concepts, mentions of greenwashing and boundaries. How do you plan, scale it, do the conceptual site model, the framework, how do you investigate, optimize, and transition, and a summary of the tools and technologies that are going to be available. On slide 29, we see the status that's in progress right now, and it's going to have going to hopefully provide a very simplified approach for the approach for the state regulator who's going to have limited experience in this. On slide 30, where do we go from here? Well, there's a survey of state interest. There's 25 states are very interested in this. I'm sure the others are too. That there's going to be training. There are going to be links to these various bunches of acronyms, which is remediation risk management, performance-based environmental management, remedial process optimization, and training on conceptual site modeling, performance-based environmental management, performance-based contracting, and GSR metrics standards and the like. On slide 31, if you have any questions, here are the contact points. Tom is the team leader. Rebecca is the co-leader. Sriram Madhubushi is the support for that team. And I'm the project officer, and all of our numbers are there. So thank you very much, and we'll be taking questions after a couple of presentations.
Thank you, Kirby.
Thanks for that
was a lot of information. So going to the next presentation, it's the updates on the green remediation efforts in EPA, Region 5, by Brad Bradley. Brad, take it away.
Okay, you can hear me, correct?
Yes, we can.
We can.
Okay, good. I'm Brad Bradley, and I'm the Greener Cleanup Coordinator for Superfund in Region 5. At the original NARPM conference of last year, Gary Victorine from our RECRA program, which we call Land and Chemicals Division, made this presentation. I didn't put together any slides. I'll just kind of run you through what Gary talked about, and then we do have some things that have occurred since the NARPM conference last year. So most of what we're doing grows out of our interim greener cleanup policy, which was signed by the Superfund and Land and Chemicals Division directors in November of 2009. It covers all of our cleanup programs. And probably the thing that's most imminent right now is that we have three white papers that derive directly from our interim policy that deal with construction and demolition materials, reuse, and soil amendments and using things we generate on site, such as fly ash and other things that we come into and clean up, dealing with cleanups, that many of which can be reused. And we just briefed our two division directors on that this week, and we plan to have those out at the end of February. So those will be informative, and we'll share them with everybody through the websites and send them so that they can be posted on Cluin too. Secondly, I wanted to just mention something for the RECRA program since Gary wasn't able to make it. RECRA has done a lot in terms of having a really comprehensive website for greener cleanups, and Gary has also put on a lot of training that we're going to basically adopt and put on for Superfund personnel, not only staff, but managers, and also take some of that out to the States. So I wanted to give a nod to Gary there because he developed some good training for us. We also, as far as Brownfields goes, which is actually under the Superfund program in Region 5, we have done a couple of things. One is that one of my colleagues had one of the contractors. We have, instead of a feasibility study, we use something called an analysis of brownfield cleanup alternatives. It's similar to a feasibility study, but not nine criteria. Actually, we use a few less. And what my colleague did was have the contractor actually put in green considerations as one of the weighing factors, and weighing that basically equally with the other factors. It turns that was with the city of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, was willing to allow us to do that. So that is one thing where we're making some progress, is getting green considerations into these what we call ABCAs, Analysis of Brownfield Cleanups Alternatives. And then we also issued a statement that we sent to our grantees for 2010, and we plan to send out as well in the future, that greener cleanup activities can be eligible costs. So under the grants that we give out, the grantees can really only use the money for eligible costs, and we clarified that if you have a direct link between your greener cleanup efforts and the cleanup itself, that would be an eligible cost. A simple example of that would be if you have a pump and treat system that's established as part of your cleanup, using solar or wind to help power that would be something that's an eligible cost. You know, putting that in and maintaining that can be an eligible cost. But on the contrary, if you had a cleanup that was something such as a soil removal and you had a building on the same site where you put solar panels on the building and it had nothing to do with that cleanup, then that would not be an eligible cost. But that is one thing some of our grantees struggle with in terms of meeting cost share requirements. So that was fairly helpful to allow them to sort of know what was and wasn't eligible with respect to green cleanups. Another thing we're doing, we have a couple of pilot projects, and I wish I had a little bit more to report on those, but they are starting to ramp up now. We have one where we're greening and optimizing a 11-year-old pump and treat system on a Superfund site, and that's just getting to where we're starting the footprinting analyses. And then the second one, we're actually taking a landfill which has some methane production and looking at some options to basically green that system. Right now, they're taking the landfill gas that's generated and flaring it. Well, that's better than putting methane directly into the atmosphere, but we think we can do a lot better. We're looking at using that methane as a possible fuel source to run a microturbine, and also use some of the waste heat from the flaring to run a Stirling engine and or use a solar trough to power a Stirling engine to help with their energy demands at that site. And that one is just getting to the beginning of the footprinting analyses, too. And the last thing I wanted to mention was that we do have a state EPA work group in Region 5. It's been very helpful to have representatives of the six states, and we cover almost all of the cleanup programs in the six states to help us with developing the white papers that we're going to release. Kirby mentioned Rebecca Borden. She's one of the people from Minnesota that is on the state EPA Greener Cleanup Work Group. And so we do have the benefit of running a lot of our issues and thoughts by a larger audience, and that's been very useful. And that's pretty much, that's our update, and I'll let the next person talk then.
Brad?
Sure.
For those that had questions, Brad, as he pointed out, didn't have any slides for his presentation for the update on EPA Region 5. We're now going on to the update from EPA Region 6 by Raji Joseph, and she does have slides, so that will, her presentation will start on slide 32. So with that, Raji Joseph from EPA Region 6. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. And this is Raji, and I'm a remedial project manager with Region 6. And if for those who are wondering what Region 6 covers, we cover Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. And slide number 33. And in Region 6 itself, what we have is we've got something called a Clean Energy and Climate Change Work Group. And this was formed in 2007. And in 2008, we came up with a Clean Energy and Climate Change Strategy. So that is for the whole region, and that encompasses all the different divisions and all the different areas. And as part of that, green remediation and renewable energy on contaminated lands falls in that strategy. And as part of the strategy, we have to develop goals every year and update those goals. And then we have to brief our upper management on where we are with those goals. And for Superfund itself, Superfund, under the Superfund program in Region 6, we have Superfund and Brownfields. And Superfund, the program itself, we have a clean and green policy, which was signed in September of 2009. And this is all these documents are available on the web. And if anybody is interested, you can send me an email, or later on you can send me an email and I can tell you where it is. But it's publicly available. And in order to address all these different goals, what we have is we have an ad hoc work group. There is no formal name to it, but this encompasses the USC program and the RCRA program and the Superfund program, and we have folks representing all these, and then we meet on a periodic basis to assess where things are and how to address these goals. And like Brad mentioned, in our region too, we offer webinars, and even this kind of webinar, we let our states know, and we offer it to the different states and tribal staff. And we have other webinars as well. And one of the trainings done last year in 2009 and 2010 by RCRA was they provide sustainable revitalization training. So they provided that last year to Texas and Louisiana state project managers, and this year they're planning it for other states. Just a caveat, it all depends on travel funds. And I'll just touch base on just a few projects that we have going on in Region 6 itself. One of the most recent ones is the Chevron mining site in New Mexico, and it's a EPA Superfund site, and the ROD was issued in 2009. And so EPA has been working with Chevron to include plans for solar energy facility on the tailing facility itself. And so right now the construction of the 1 megawatt solar facility at Cuesta, New Mexico is complete. And as part of the ROD, what they have in the ROD is they have that this project has to demonstrate, like, for 5 years, the CPV technology. And also, typically you have 3-foot covers, but this project, one of the things that they're going to demonstrate is effectiveness of using either 1-foot, 2-foot, 3-foot covers, based on the CPV technology. As of last week, the energy has been provided to the utility transmission line, and the utility itself is Kit Carlson Alexa Cooperative. Another project in Austin that's going on is the Holly Street Power Plant project, and it is Brownfields project, and EPA along with NREL are working with Austin Energy and City of Austin Parks Department, and EPA is more like providing more of a consultancy role here, so they've been providing recommendations as to how to go about decommissioning this Holly Street power plant, and they just recently had another meeting in January, and EPA is going to provide the consultancy role and make sure and provide them whatever information they need to decommission this plant in a most sustainable way. And then they are going to be revitalizing this area as well. And so they are going to seek EPA's guidance on that. And another project underway is the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico itself. And this is actually a project that EPA and DOT have been coordinating efforts under the ARRA funding, and that's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding. And so they have, they promoted like the development of the former trading post in that area, and also a new train station has been constructed, the Roadrunner train station with the ARRA funds. And just recently, the phase one environmental site assessment has been completed to the former housing site, and that is the brownfield site. And as part of this, they are using our Region 6 green remediation principles. And another project underway is the State Road 114 Superfund site. And Vince Millard, he's the RPM on this, and he's going to give you more details in the second half of today's webinar. What that is it's a cryogenic compression and condensation technology that's being used to recover SE from groundwater plume, and he's planning a carbon footprint evaluation in this during this year, and he'll talk more about it. And another project underway is Grant's chlorinated solvent site. It's a Superfund site. It's in New Mexico, and the ROD for the site was signed in 2006, and it's a PCE contaminated site due to dry cleaning operations. And they also got ARRA funding for treatment of the groundwater plume. And one of the things as a pilot project, what the RPM is doing for this site is doing a carbon footprint evaluation using the different tools available right now, like the Bettles site-wise, and then AFSI's sustainable remediation tool and CIMA Pro. So he's doing it for the existing technology, and the technologies that are being used at the site are thermal remediation for the source area, and for the plume itself, they're using vegetable oil injection for dechlorination. And then there are numerous other or several other projects in the works at different stages, and some of them are in conceptual stages and some of them are just being addressed right now. And one of the things, like Brad mentioned, in our region as well, we have environmentally preferable practices language in our contracts, especially the removal contracts. We have this in all their contracts, and so the contractors have to report out based on what was specified in their contracts. And in terms of the report out has to be mainly in terms of waste minimization, materials management, resource conservation, and reduction in emissions. And just observations, what's going on with all these various things going on in the region is one thing is there are different awareness levels among the RPMs. Some of them are able to take on and greener remediation and run with it, and some of them there are challenges because we are all constrained by time, funding, resources. And one of the other challenges is where do we go? Because the guidance is just coming out, and how do we go about doing things? So that's one challenge. And also like steep learning curve, because all this is, we're doing this new, and so where do we go from here? So those are some of the challenges we are having. And that's pretty much it, and that's my contact information. And if you all have questions, send those to me, and I can refer you to the specific RPMs on these projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Raji. At this point, we're going into the first part of the question and answer session for this webinar. For phone participants, if you want to take your phones off mute to ask a question, hit #6. When you do, please indicate your name, the firm you're with, and if there's a specific slide that your question pertains to, if you could indicate that along with which speaker the question is intended for, we'd appreciate it. After a period, we'll go to the webinar participants and then back to the phone lines. So I'll open the floor up for the phone lines participants at this point. Any questions for our speakers? Wow, you guys did a great job, speakers. No questions. Well, while our vote participants are thinking up a question, I'll bring up one of the...
This is my class from Region 2. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This probably everybody knows the answer to this, but what is a Stirling engine? I think the Region 5 presenter had raised that as one of the devices they were using.
Okay, what a Stirling engine is like an external combustion engine. It actually just uses carrier oil, the differential heating from one side to the other to turn a piston and actually create energy. So it's been around a long time, but the only applications that I've really seen with respect to greener cleanups would really be larger applications. I think right now a lot of the applications are in the power industry where you have a lot of waste heat from burning coal and other fuels, but they're able at this point to start scaling those down and do the same idea with things like landfill flares and smaller sources of waste heat.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Raji?
Raji?
Yes, Raji. My name is Ann Thompson. I'm with Public Works. It's a government agency in Canada, and we're quite involved, getting quite involved in the whole area of green and sustainable remediation. And what I was curious about was whether the environmental practices that are being incorporated into your contracts, whether it's possible to get some examples of that.
Yes, I can definitely, I can talk to our contracting folks, and we have some language that they can provide, and yes, I can definitely do that. What you can do is...
I've got your email.
Yeah, so just go ahead, send me an email, and I'll talk
to
our contracting folks and get you that.
Hi, this is Kirby. I just wanted to point out that on the Clue-In website that we are currently on, there is a green remediation component of that, which has a green remediation contracting toolkit. That provides lots and lots of information about how to provide contracting language that supports green remediation. So I just wanted to point you to that as well.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I've also had extensive discussions with Carlos Pachon as well.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry to...
Okay.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure you knew about it.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question. Any other questions from our phone participants? Then I'm going to go to the simulcast questions we've received on simulcast. First question is from Aaron Schulman from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the question is for Raji. On slide 35, there's a acronym TV. What is that?
Sorry. It's concentrated photovoltaic technology.
Okay. I thought that was what it might be, but I wasn't sure. Okay, thank you. And then the second question is for Kirby. Greg?
Okay.
Did you mention that the Clue-In Green Remediation, Green and Sustainable Remediation GSR will be closing in 2011? Can you explain? And that question was from Angela Fisher at GEGRC.
Okay. When I say closing in 2011, what I mean is that the team is expecting to finish their technical regulatory document during this 2011 year, during calendar year 2011. So closing means that the technical document will be produced, and then in the next year, 2012, is when the internet-based training will be developed and delivered. It's actually under development now, but it will be delivered first at the end of 2011 or the beginning of 2012. Does that answer the question?
I hope so. I will let you know.
Okay.
And we'll go back to the phone participants. Does anyone have any additional questions for our speakers in this portion of the webinar?
Hi, Suzanne. This is Mike Gill. It's actually a question for Raji. On that same slide 35, there's a mention of doing the pilot demonstration for 5 years to test concentrating PV technology and evaluate the effectiveness of 1, 2, and 3 foot cover depths.
Right.
Can you explain what the 1, 2, and 3 foot cover depths are?
You know what? I'm not very familiar with the project itself, but I know, at least looking at the rod, what they had in there was, as part of the pilot project, they were saying that typically you use 3-foot cover depths, but this was to do a combination of 1 foot with the solar panels and then 2 foot with the solar panels, and then compare it to the 3-foot cover depths. And if you want more information, I can point you to our RPM, and the RPM is Mark Purcell. And, Mike, I can follow up with you on that.
Okay, that's fine. It sounds like it might be a construction spec for the cover over the mine tailings, but I was just curious.
Yeah, that sounds like it to me too, Mike. Yeah.
Oh, and Kirby, just a follow-up. Yes, you did answer the question.
Okay, thanks. And by the way, that team is still open to people coming in. So if you want to join that team, you can go to the ITRC web.org website and take a look at the team and what it's doing. So, and maybe volunteer for it for this round if you want. I think registration is still open. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for speakers? I haven't received any from the simulcast, so again, opening the lineup for the phone participants. All right. Well, we've got a second Q&A session at the end. If we have time, we will entertain more questions from the first half. Otherwise, we'll move on to the second half, which is the case studies portion of this webinar. And with that, we will have, starting off with the case studies portion, Tim Sprinesfield at EPA Region 10 will be giving a presentation on PRP's approach to greener remediation in the LDW site RIFS. For the remedial investigation feasibility study. And with that, we'll go to Tim. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, okay, so this is Tim Brinsfield, EPA Region 10, Office of Environmental Cleanup. I'm Senior Policy Advisor. I work with the Superfund program and the Brownfields program here in the region. I'm a former RPM, also former Brownfields coordinator, so I've worked in both parts of the program and made countless mistakes and learned a few things along the way. Our office has a clean and green policy in effect and that we're all subject to and following. The leaders of our efforts here in green remediation in the region, and I'm doing this from my desk. There's a group of people in a room elsewhere, so I can acknowledge them, I hope, and Unit Manager Beth Sheldrake is one of the leaders, does a lot of work in this area. RPM Sean Sheldrake is not only a leader, but a guru and evangelist and himself putting these principles into practice at his sites and available and eager to help other RPMs here in our region and for that matter other regions with their work. Also, a leader in this effort on our Brownfields team is Brooks Stanfield. And then our recently, selected science and technology policy advisor from ORD, Kira Lynch, former RPM who will be presenting after me. All of them are very knowledgeable and very supportive of this effort, and collectively we offer ourselves as advisors to anyone that wants help in this area, and sometimes offer ourselves as advisors to people who don't want help, but nonetheless. And I'm giving this presentation on this site, the Lower Duwamish Superfund site here in the Seattle area, on behalf of the RPM for this site, Remedial Project Manager for the site, Allison Hiltner. Allison, far more intimately involved in the project and knowledgeable of the site, but had a conflict when this presentation was scheduled at NARPM. So since I've been helping her, I'm presenting this on her behalf. And if you go through the slides, there's a slide showing the Lower Duwamish waterway itself, just to give you a sense. It's the long, thin blue line running through the middle of the city of Seattle and then emptying into Elliott Bay. again, I'm originally from the East Coast, now living on the West Coast, and the legacy of human use and contamination is shorter on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast. But nonetheless, this has been an industrial corridor for the city of Seattle for almost, well, for over 100 years now. And so the Lower Duwamish site is dealing with legacy and ongoing pollution, sediments, in the Duwamish waterway. And again, large urban, next slide, the status of the large urban river and sediment site. There are four major potentially responsible parties who are performing the remedial investigation and feasibility study and doing early actions. They're listed here, but basically three public entities and the Boeing Company. There are many other past and present contributors to the sediment contamination, to include all of us that live in the area through the combined sewers that empty into the area and runoff. As we all know, that non-point source runoff is an ever greater contributor. But these other four entities, these four entities have some potential responsibility under the statute, so they're doing this work. And they provided us last spring with a draft of the feasibility study, which is the subject of this presentation that was originally given in May. We are currently commenting on the revised draft of the feasibility study. The next slide, just to give you a little bit of sense, as I already started to mention about the pollution sources to the Duwamish: stormwater runoff, contaminated soil or groundwater, combined sewer system overflows, direct discharges, and air deposition, which eventually has led, or in the past, and in the past has led to pollutants ending up in the sediment. And I lost the slides myself, so I can't follow my own presentation. Just a moment. So the next slide, then, the primary contaminants of concern in the sediments: polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, arsenic, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, I'm tripping over my tongue today, and dioxins and furans. Those are the four main contaminants of concern in the sediments. The next slide is the kind of cartoon version of the conceptual site model of how deposition and other mechanisms have led to pollution in the sediment, and some representations of some of the affected organisms and the exposure pathways that can lead eventually to humans and wildlife and creatures living in the sediments or eating those. So can give you some sense of the site itself. And in the next slide, in terms of human health risk assessment, a summary of the conceptual site model issues with respect to human health risk. Again, the primary pathways of concern would be dermal contact, incidental ingestion of sediments from beach play, working in the area, fishing in the area, and then consumption of fish and shellfish. And in addition to concern about people in general being exposed, we have a very high level of concern about tribal exposure, because tribal members and Asian Pacific Islanders tend to be the highest consumers of the fish and shellfish from the area. Tribal treaty rights currently interpreted to allow them up to 50% of the catch from these areas, and Asian Pacific Islanders are a minority population here that has been observed to be heavy users of the area. Then the next slide summarizes the remedial technology options which have been developed for this site and worked into the feasibility study. These are the main options: dredging and off-site disposal, capping, and monitored natural recovery. And then the alternatives constructed for the feasibility study for evaluation against the 9 criteria per the Superfund process are really then some combination of these to try to address the contaminated sediments. And in general, the sediment contamination, while significant and posing an unacceptable risk, is not gross principal threat material, except in some very limited areas which are the subject of the early actions that are going on, but primarily diffuse low-level contamination that has effect on the environment and then through the food chain on people. So, again, the alternatives are constructed to try to address the contamination in an effective way pursuant to the criteria. All of the alternatives are heavily dependent on source control because, again, while there are past sources of the contamination, there are also ongoing sources, again, primarily through the stormwater pathway and the runoff pathway. So in addition to source control and some combination of these technologies, we anticipate the selected remedy is likely to also require, well, will require, institutional controls and operation and maintenance of the ICs and some of the other procedures for a long period of time. Again, the next slide then summarizes the likely preferred alternative based on the draft feasibility study we've seen so far. And the potentially responsible parties strongly prefer the monitored natural recovery approach, by which we mean, for those not familiar with that, basically allowing the ongoing process of sedimentation in the river to continue to scour and cover the sediments site. Again, there are some early actions, dredging and removal or capping going on, but primarily we're looking at monitored natural recovery going on. The larger the dredge footprint, the more contaminants of concern would be expected to remove from the environment. But here's where the gist of this presentation and their approach to greener remediation comes in. The responsible parties are arguing against doing any active form of remediation, and they're using the feasibility study to do this. They've focused in part on one of the nine criteria, short-term effectiveness, and come up with what they call sustainability metrics. And in our opinion is in the agency, they have carried this rather further than our Superfund guidance calls for and the National Contingency Plan allows. They are not only looking at what we traditionally and appropriately think of as short-term effectiveness to include the effects that could be mitigated, but also a great deal of other information that we're not as convinced is appropriate to include there. Their conclusion is that dredging and offsite disposal and, frankly, any active remediation will have negative impacts that outweigh the benefits. And they are not following an important part of EPA's guidance, which is to first identify any short-term impacts and then to discuss in the feasibility study how to mitigate those impacts. This is clearly iterated in Superfund guidance, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study guidance in the NCP, and in our Clean and Green policy and related documents, and in the comments and discussions we've had with them. And this was really the point of the whole presentation, is to raise awareness within the agency and to support additional discussion that we're very concerned that green remediation should not be used to justify no action. I mentioned that they were focusing on short-term effectiveness, but as it shows on the next slide, responsible parties have also then carried that argument heavily into other of the nine criteria. In particular, one of the two threshold criteria of overall protectiveness of public health and the environment, and we've kind of done some competing arguments with respect to what language in the National Contingency Plan supports our various positions. We feel strongly that what they have done, which they say is to use this as a heavy criteria, their sustainability metrics as a heavy criteria in the short-term effectiveness evaluation, and then carried that up into the protection of public health and the environment, again, to basically argue that this problem that are caused in terms of mobilizing contamination and putting dredgers at risk. They were argued very heavily that operating a dredge is a risky business, and therefore any risks that they can find in information about occupational health from dredging should be weighed against the potential risk from exposure to the contaminants, which we don't think is how the criteria are designed or intended to be used. And then particularly when we get into overall protection, public health, and the environment, the focus needs to be on the unacceptable risk posed by the hazardous substance pollutants or contaminants and not related to other activities. So next slide, again, more discussion that we think is supportive of our view and position. The Principle for Greener Cleanups memorandum from the AA for OSWER issued in August of 2009, that we don't consider cleanups that don't satisfy the threshold to be greener. The Principle for Greener Cleanups is not intended to trade cleanup program objectives for other environmental objectives, that we're still supposed to follow the traditional process, the requirements of the statute, National Contingency Plan, and pick the alternative that best meets threshold criteria and provides the best balance, and that the emphasis in the feasibility study should be on making the selected remedy greener and not using the arguments that, such as the ones these PRPs are making, and that we're hearing from other responsible parties, both in the private sector and in the public sector, that basically have tried repeatedly and continue to try to argue that no action or passive action, such as allowing monitored natural recovery or monitored natural attenuation, is a greener way to deal with basically any form of pollution as opposed to taking active measures. Then on the next slide, again, one of the key points we make with them, and we encourage others to be making with their responsible parties if they're making these sort of arguments, and that a very important principle for us to be following as we ourselves write feasibility studies, is that using the feasibility study evaluation and the feasibility study process to identify any impacts, and then most importantly, to develop mitigation options and to put those into the feasibility study. We think that that's the important information that needs to be developed and well documented in the feasibility study, which will then support the administrative record down the line. And these then will come into play very heavily in the remedial design after selection of the action. We are glad that the Headquarters Office of Superfund Remediation Technology, Remedial Technology Investigation, I'm getting that wrong, but I was ready, is working on and has been working on remediation guidance. My understanding is that that is still in draft, and Robin Anderson, who's the principal on that, was unable to be part of this presentation today, but we're very eager for that to come out. I think all of us within the agency and those outside would benefit from further guidance on the appropriate ways to incorporate green and greener remediation into our Superfund feasibility studies and the similar work that goes on in the Brownfields program in terms of evaluating cleanup alternatives. We in the region do not support, and we understand headquarters does not support, trying to invent or add a 10th criteria to the 9 criteria specified in the National Contingency Plan for evaluating, that it's important to work greener remediation into the existing criteria and statutory framework that we have. We've found so far that we think the most appropriate of those criteria is the short-term effectiveness criteria, and that's an efficient and appropriate way to build in greener remediation. There are other criteria where there are some lesser opportunities, but we think that it's really can lead to the sort of approach that the responsible parties have taken at the Lower Duwamish site of basically trying to take one point, their effort to argue against active remediation, and try to build that into every criteria. And so we would strongly recommend that we continue to focus on it under short-term effectiveness. So these strong recommendations come up on the next slide. Again, as I said, we're limiting the discussion to short-term effectiveness and emphasizing the mitigation. That work on mitigation would continue in the remedial design phase, that the weighting of the nine criteria, the two threshold followed by the five balancing, works and is appropriate and should not be changed with the new guidance, that as the 2009 memo from the assistant administrator reiterated, remedy selection should go on as it has before, and that short-term effectiveness as one of the criteria in remedy selection should have no more weight, but also no less weight than it has in the date, and that greener remediation should not drive the remedy decision, but it should inform the remedy decision and inform the remedial design. Let's see. And that's the end of the slides and the real gist of the presentation. And with that, I will shut up and happily take any questions.
Thank you for your presentation, Tim. We're going to hold on questions to the end of the session. And so if for all of you, please just write down your burning questions for Tim. And we're going to move on to Kara Lynch, who's also in US EPA Region 10. And her presentation will be Green Remediation Elements of the South Tacoma Channel Well 12A Excavation Design. And Kara, we're just going to shift the time, so take it away.
Okay, great, Suzanne. So I'm on slide 59 now, and I'm going to talk about the Well 12A site, which is a solvent recovery facility in Tacoma. So the main contaminant of concern is TCE, and we did a ROD amendment in October 2009, focusing on doing additional actions to reduce the source strength in the DNAPL area of the site. So in that ROD amendment, we did add in a statement that basically went into Section 7.1, the protection of human health and the environment, that referenced the importance of considering green remediation and optimizing the design with that in consideration. But consistent with what Tim had mentioned earlier, we thought it was important to point out that those opportunities should be sought consistent with the REOs. So those opportunities are being considered, but they're being considered with technologies that are going to achieve the protectiveness criteria of the remedy. Going on to slide number 60, we did perform a green remediation evaluation to look at the environmental footprint of the selected remedy and identify the largest contributors to the footprint, and basically identify potential options for reducing that environmental footprint. With this particular site, we have a unique opportunity because it is a site where we're targeting a DNAPL source area, and the approach for that DNAPL source area is a combined remedy approach. So we are using a combination of looking at excavation of part of the site, in situ thermal remediation for part of the site, and then enhanced bio, with a goal of achieving a flux-based reduction upgradient of a flux line using those three technologies. So we have a unique opportunity here from the standpoint of the green remediation evaluation to look at opportunities to kind of change the boundaries and look at how we're combining and utilizing those three technologies and optimizing that from the standpoint of looking at the environmental footprint. So this next slide is a little busy, but basically it shows what we did with the various components. We have excavation in the first column. We have in-situ thermal remediation in the second, enhanced anaerobic bioremediation in the third, And then we also have an existing groundwater extraction and treatment system. And what we looked at is we looked at each of these technologies and looked at the environmental footprint for the various factors. And what the red is that's the highest unit footprint for that particular metric, and the green is the lowest. And it was actually, we've had some interesting findings from going through this analysis. And one of the interesting findings for me, going on to slide number 62, was that the excavation and off-site disposal was determined to have the greatest unit footprint per cubic yard by most of the metrics evaluated. And I think one of the reasons that was interesting to me is that one of the technologies that we are looking at is in-situ thermal remediation. And just kind of intuitively, you would think that because of the nature of in-situ thermal remediation, that would have a really significant environmental footprint because you're using so much energy. But because 98% of Tacoma's electricity is generated from hydroelectric and nuclear sources, it actually had a lower environmental footprint when you looked at the life cycle analysis. So I think one of these things is that what this taught me is that going through kind of a thorough life cycle evaluation can really be useful for helping us to look at how do we optimize and combine technologies on some of these sites. So going on to slide number 63, one of the outputs that we used from this green remediation evaluation is, like I said, we looked at what our options were for potentially reducing the excavation footprint and expanding the in-situ thermal into areas that we were planning to excavate, because we can achieve the same RAOs by doing that, and we were also able to show that would have a lower environmental footprint. So we did reduce the excavation depth and increase the depth where we were targeting the in-situ thermal for. Going on to slide number 64, some of the other outcomes of this evaluation that we have built into the specifications for the excavation component of the design, which is the first step in the multi-step source area remediation, is that there are a number of factors identified to be able to green the transportation and disposal of the contaminated soil that was going to be removed. So in those specifications, we have preferences for using local borough sources and disposal facilities. We also have requirements for having the concrete segregated and recycled locally. And the soil we have pre-characterized for disposal at the nearest Subtitle C landfill to minimize the transportation. And we also have made a requirement prior to disposal, the treatment facility generates energy from the treatment process, which goes back into the grid and is sold to the city of Seattle. And then finally, one of the components of the excavation specifications is also that we've required the contractor to do a transportation analysis and to show us that they selected the transportation method that would allow the cleanest transportation of the excavated material to a facility. So these are all factors that fall in the category of not changing the remedy, but ways that we can look at the specifications for the selected remedy that we selected and make them greener. So going on to slide number 65, in a similar vein, we also looked at specification changes that we could make in regards to minimizing diesel emissions. And so along those lines, we have a no idling policy for all vehicles and equipment. We also require the use of cleaner engines and cleaner fuel and diesel emission control technology within the specifications. And there is a requirement for the contractor to track emissions reduced during the actual remediation process. So then, just finally, some of the other factors that we're looking at, we are looking at an investigation design to try to help optimize the area that we're looking at for the thermal treatment. We do have a clause that we built into the actual thermal treatment specifications that we're just developing right now that does require the contractors bidding on that to also look at and consider and make recommendations on cleaner energy sources that they could be using for the actual remediation itself. We're also looking at some improvements to the stormwater system and also looking at improvements that can be done from the existing roof drains and disconnecting those from the sanitary sewer during the restoration process. So, and with that, that's my last slide.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Akira. And if we, again, if you could save your questions to the question and answer session, appreciate it. And we're going to go to our last speaker for the case study section, and that would be Vince Malott from EPA Region 6, and his talk is on green treatment technology for SVE systems.
Great. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you.
This site did not start out as a green remediation type project. It was it's a fairly large scale groundwater plume site located out in Levelland, Texas, which is in just west of Lubbock. That's slide 68. And the picture here is of a playa that was used as a disposal area for refinery waste from the facility operations back from the late 30s all the way up into the early 50s. And the area out there is truly dependent on groundwater as a principal supply of their drinking water and also agricultural water out there for a lot of the farming activity. So the groundwater is an extremely important component, and really that's why the site was on the national priorities list, slide 69. And a little bit of the background there, it's a fairly large-scale refinery that operated for a short time during World War II, and then after that, as far as processing a lot of the oil from the local oil field, the Hockley County oil field. And it generated a lot of the refined products, aviation fuels, diesels, gasoline. So a wide range of products that were used. And unfortunately, the wastes were disposed almost everywhere. There was it's pretty haphazard as far as waste management out there for that time frame. So a lot of emphasis on production and not much else on controlling the spills and other disposal activities. The site's already been redeveloped. It's actually occupied as a grain storage and transfer area for the local farmers cooperative. So a lot of the Milo production goes to this facility for shipment by rail and truck. Slide 70. So the groundwater is fairly deep. It's been heavily used by both the nearby city of Levelland as well as agricultural water. And you can see some of the specifics on the aquifer parameters as well. And the resulting release, has generated a little over a mile long groundwater plume containing benzene and 1,2-dichloroethane. And of course the 1,2-DCA is part of the leaded gasoline production process. And then also we have a relatively thin pancake layer essentially of L-NAPL beneath the facility property, especially beneath the principal production areas of the refinery itself. Slide 71. And the there's a mistake on the title of this particular slide. It should be August of 2010. But this is the 1,2-dichloroethane. And the facility, or the former refinery, is located on the western extent of the plume that's on there. Groundwater flow is generally from west to east, or slightly west to northeast. And so the yellow and the orange areas at the far western part is the principal area of the former refinery. That kind of a triangular shaped property extends off to the east. Slide 72 is of the benzene plume. As you can see, its biodegradation probably limited the leading edge of that plume itself. And the highest concentrations are located beneath the refinery property there. Slide 73. So the remedial action objectives included the typical ones for groundwater of exposure prevention, which we handled to a separate drinking water line extended to residents who were exposed. We also had...
This is Mike Gill. Can you hear that beep, beep, beep? Or, I don't know if it's our phone or your... If it's bothering you, let me know, and I'll mute everybody else. Can you hear something?
I can.
Yeah, I can, too. I was just going to ask.
Yeah, I can, too.
Yeah, could maybe a global mute, and then...
Well, it seems like it may have stopped, but I wanted to nip it in the bud if it wasn't going to. All right, let's continue.
Thanks. All right, so for the pump and treat system that we ended up having for the site, you know, plume migration and restoration for the groundwater itself, and the remedial goals were the drinking water limits for benzene and 1,2 DCA at 5 micrograms per liter. Slide 74. So in addition to the groundwater system, we had the SVE system as an additional component to address, obviously, the high or the presence of high concentrations of organic vapors beneath the former refinery as well as the LMAP lot there. And we, the whole issue of the green remediation at State Road 114 really came out as a result of how best to address these really high concentrations of organic vapors and what's the best way to manage that waste and accelerate the cleanup out there. And so during the design process, we came into contact with this particular treatment technology, and we saw this as a way to really to expedite the process. So again, it didn't start out as a green remediation approach. It was more of what's the most effective way to deal with the high concentrations out there. And so one of the common concerns from the public out there was the presence of smells from both oil field production as well as some nearby gas plant operations. And so we were cognizant of the concerns from the local residents as far as impacting the air quality out there during those times when the wind's not blowing 20 to 30 miles an hour. But we also wanted to maximize the SVE production rates, and we didn't want to have restrictions on our treatment technology as far as how much material we might be able to produce. And slide 75 lays out kind of the financial considerations. For those who are not familiar with this, EPA provides 90% of the funding for the first 10 years, what we call the long-term remedial action. So after the remedy's been constructed and determined to be complete and operational, so we have 10 years in which we provide the bulk of the funding, and after that, the state assumes 100% of the cost. And so we have kind of a ticking clock here that reaches the end in year 2020. And so we wanted to have as much reduction in the concentrations out there in both the groundwater and the SVE system. Slide 76 shows the general scope of the groundwater extraction system. So we're moving quite a bit of water in an effort to expedite the cleanup out there. The city of Levelland was impacted. They've actually been very cooperative. They shut down their westernmost well field to avoid pulling in any of the contamination while we had our system up and running. So hopefully we'll have all those objectives achieved as well. And slide 77 shows the general outlay of the groundwater extraction system and the injection field. The black diamonds in the center of the figure there are the on-site extraction wells, and of course the off-site extraction wells. There's both black diamonds and some red triangles, and the injection field is up on the north side, the blue squares. So it's a fairly widespread plume, requiring a lot of water management as well as disposal activities. The other primary component is the soil vapor extraction system. There are 62 well locations, and we have separate completions in both an upper and a lower zone. And of course, the lower zone is the primary interval as far as recovery of organic vapors. And you can see some of the specifics on the estimated volumes as well as thicknesses. I want to point out the pilot test results on that last bullet, and keep those in mind, and I'll show you what the results were for some of the initial startup monitoring we've had on the SVE system. We've actually pretty close to what we saw on the pilot test. But as you notice, the deep zone influent is the primary zone for recovery of organic vapors. Slide 79 is the SVE well field layout. The treatment facility is on the north side of the two long warehouse buildings on the left side of the figure there. You'll see kind of a grayed out area surrounding a red stippled rectangle, and that's the treatment facility. So I believe there's almost 25,000 feet of pipe from the SVE system that goes back to that treatment facility. So we're moving quite a bit of material on there. Slide 80. There's the typical components for a groundwater extraction system. We do have metals, of course, that are released from the aquifer material, including manganese and arsenic that we have to deal with. But one of the things we looked at is what could we do if we're going to go with the system for treatment of the SVE extracted vapors, is how could we capture the expected vapors from the airstrip as well. And so that is what's routed through the ZLI rotor concentrator. It's a Munter's wheel that allows us to collect all the vapors and essentially go to a zero-emission treatment facility out there. And, of course, then everything is condensed down into a liquid that is then much more easily managed and can then be shipped off for recycling. Slide 81, 82, and 83 are actually animations in the PowerPoint, but they won't be operational for the webinar here today. But they're really a nice way to get an idea of the size and the scope of the treatment system. On slide 81, the air strippers are in green on the top half of the figure. The metal system is the purple tanks on the lower half of the figure. And the SVE system is the yellow headers on the upper part of the figure that goes into the system. And so the off-gas from the air strippers is routed to the green piping, which then when you go to slide 82, you'll see come in at the top of the figure, and that's where it goes into the Munter's ZLI wheel for concentrating and capture. And then slide 83 is just another view of the Munter's ZLI wheel on the upper part, and then the individual components of the cryogenic compression and condensation system. So the system itself, I'll speak before we get into the performance data, it's designed to be a more or less a modular system that allows us to ramp down production as we start to take some of these SVE wells offline in the future. And as concentrations decline even more below a future break-even point, we can route the vapor through the Munter's zeolite wheel as well. So we have five individual 500 CFM units. One's attached to the off-gas production from the Munter's zeolite well. Another 500 CFM unit addresses production from the upper zone of the SVE system. And then we have three 500 CFM units for the lower production zone. So it gives us a lot of capacity. We don't have any restrictions on total extracted vapors, so we don't have to worry about future upsets, say, on a Thermox unit or some other treatment technology. And essentially, we have unlimited production, so as much vapor as we can produce then is translated into a liquid waste that we can then manage much more efficiently. Slide 84 shows the performance data, kind of some of the ones that we're looking at, especially energy costs versus revenue from the recovered waste that we can then use as or sent to fuel recyclers. Slide 85 shows some of the analysis of the initial influent right after startup from September in 2009 all the way through March of 2010. The analysis that was conducted in November, the one you see there in green, around a little over 95,000 on the parts per million by volume. The question is whether or how accurate that particular measurement was. But if you look at the rest of the measurements, they're all pretty much in line with what we saw in the pilot test. The shallow SVE system, those measurements there appear to be more of an average from what we saw in the pilot test. But the deep SVE system is pretty much tracking in line with what we saw in the pilot test. So we're recovering pretty much what we saw at the time. And in slide 86, is an updated one through the end of 2010, and you'll see it's been a fairly steady product generation out there. not product, but recovered waste material. The initial slope, we had a lot of material coming out, and you see there's a area during February of 2010, kind of a flat spot. That was a break in production when we stopped and did a overall assessment of our treatment plant operation, as well as the SVE recovery system. We had so much material coming out, we wanted to make sure that we were operating in a safe manner, because we were certainly recovering as much or more volume as what we had predicted during the remedial design. So we stopped to make sure that we were operating in a safe manner for both the employees as well as the surrounding businesses. And we put everything back into operation, and as you can see, it's been a very steady production rate out there. The next slide, slide 87, shows a breakdown of the kilowatt hour usage for the individual components. And as you can see, we're those are, I guess you could call them energy hogs as far as the amount of power that we're using for the SVE system versus the remaining of groundwater treatment system out there. So we are using quite a bit of power, but the green remediation approach is really coming into the recovery process, or the waste management issue and resource conservation. So slide 88 shows kind of the break between revenue generated from the material that is shipped off to the fuel recyclers versus our energy costs. And, of course, early on we were tracking pretty close, and then since then we started to diverge more on our slopes. But this also includes our transportation costs. And if you put the transportation cost or added it back in what we have to pay for shipping, we're actually not too far off from our power costs for operating the system out there. So we're actually receiving some benefit as far as our overall recovery system out there, and not having to sustain as a big a hit on our electrical usage out there. So slide 89, kind of the issues that we'll be going up into our next task orders for the site, especially looking at the carbon footprint analysis and when does it become more of a break-even point between our cost, the efficiency of the system, and then what our overall carbon footprint is. And so the analysis that's been done through Region 9 and elsewhere, we'll be using those models to go in there and generate that kind of carbon footprint, and then compare that with our cost and see at what point does it make sense to maybe switch over to another technology. But at the current production rate, we're not anticipating any decision points within the next few years for sure. Overall, we had looked at, given the total volume of material that we were going to be producing, that it may take more than 10 years. And with the cryogenic system, we're anticipating that we should be able to maybe get closer to 6 years or more. So we'd have a few years in savings in operating the system out there. And, of course, with the modular design, it allows us to take some of those units out of operation as we're able to start shutting down some of our soil vapor extraction wells. So we'll have the carbon footprint analysis ongoing for this year, and then when we're completed, we'll be able to share that information with everyone else through our Region 6 website, and then hopefully with future webinars as well on the green remediation process. Suzanne, that's the last slide, so take it from there.
Thank you, Ben. Well, now we'll open up the floor to questions from our phone line participants. To unmute your line, hit #6. And when you do ask your question, please identify who you are, the firm you work with, and which presenter the question is intended for. And if there's a particular slide, please give the slide number. So, questions, anybody? Okay, while our phone participants are creating a question, we've got a one on the line here. It's for Tim Brinsfield. And I believe it's regarding slide 52. And the question is from Scott McDonald over at AECOM. Starts, an identification of sustainable metrics and the associated BMPs. Oh, just moved on me, sorry. Is what Region 10 is suggesting for inclusion in an FS, correct? If sustainable metrics are not included in remedy selection, what is the incentive for a quantitative analysis?
Well, I'm not 100% sure I understand the question, to be honest, but we are not recommending the inclusion of sustainability metrics. The responsible parties invented this as far as use in an FS, and to my knowledge, and they argued in favor of that. We are strongly in favor of continuing to follow the National Contingency Plan and to evaluate remedies in terms of the 9 criteria per the statute, the NCP, and the guidance. And we stress that it's critical not only to identify short-term impacts, but more importantly, and where green remediation comes in, to identify ways to mitigate such impacts in the event that particular remedy is selected.
Okay, hopefully that answers the question. The next question is either for Kira or Tim. On slide 61, in sustainability evaluation, how did you integrate or capture the social aspect of the life cycle assessment? The slide speaks more to economic and environmental metrics. Also, how would you recommend one convey this message to clients or stakeholders? And that was from a colleague, Trevor King, here in the U.S.
So, Suzanne, this is Kira. For at least for the Time Oil project, and with what I've tried to do as far as optimizing the actual remedy that was selected to take into consideration the environmental impact, we didn't try to look at the social aspects of that at all. I think it goes back to what Tim was trying to convey in the response to the last question, is that as with what we're trying to do with an EPA, we're not necessarily driving the remedy selection based on using sustainability as one of the criteria for the selection. Where we're leaning towards is using this from the standpoint of taking into consideration the environmental impacts from the standpoint of optimizing what we've selected as the protective solution for sites.
Kira captured the point and said it better than I could. I think she's answered the question.
Okay. And I'm going to open up the floor to questions from our phone line participants. Anyone? Otherwise, I'm getting quite a few on the simulcast. Okay, back to the simulcast questions that are coming in. This one is for, again, Kira. On slide 62, you note that greater than 98% of Tacoma's electricity is hydro or nuclear. First part of the question, one, I assume this is an average and not a marginal number, but hydro and nuclear capacity in the Pacific Northwest is finite. If this project increases electricity use, will the electricity on the margin come from natural gas, coal? I'm not sure which is the appropriate figure to use, but does it make a difference? And should I just go on to the second part, or?
No, I think part of this, I'm not totally following what that question was as far as, I guess the way that I would answer it is I don't think we looked at it into the level of detail of saying, okay, well, what percentage of the energy is going to come from other sources? I mean, we looked at this from a global perspective to kind of look at what was the energy impact for each of the components of the design. So we didn't go into a detailed enough analysis to kind of look at, like, for that other percentage of energy, where would that be coming from?
Okay. And the second part of it was just a statement that EPA requires that in calculating the greenhouse gas emissions, federal agencies use EGRID emission factors, not local emission factors. The results will be less favorable if you use EGRID emission factors, since the Pacific Northwest EGRID subregion includes major parts of 7 states, including a lot of coal generation. So I guess that's just a general life cycle impact assessment.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about EGRID.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, I think I'm along the lines of many RPMs that we're just learning how to go about this, how to do these assessments. And I know that I've been working closely with Carlos, and that Carlos is working on the guidance that we're going to be using for how to conduct these green remediation assessments. So I would recommend, if that person is, you know, really interested in some of those things, that maybe they could share that information with us, and I can run it by Carlos to see what he understands about whether that should be something that we consider in looking at how we do these site-specific green remediation design evaluations.
Okay. And I'll forward that one on to you, Kara. You seem to be a very popular person. So this next question is also for Kara and the South Tacoma project. How were the contractors to work with while implementing the green remedial objectives and collecting the required metrics?
Well, you know, the excavation specifications are just out on the street right now. So I have not actually implemented that yet. Hopefully by NARPM in June, I'm going to be coming back and being able to give some input on kind of how the implementation phase of these specifications, what worked and what didn't, what contract language seemed to be the best to be able to achieve the results we wanted. But at this point right now, like I said, this has been built into the specifications, and the specifications are out there for bid right now, but I haven't actually implemented them.
Okay. And then this next question from Raleigh Castile is for the group. What has your experience been with consultants and contractors in accepting and implementing the new sustainable approaches? A willingness to participate and accomplish the objectives, or pushback?
From my standpoint, I've seen a really, like, a willingness to work with us, to look at these opportunities, not only from the contractors that we've worked with, but at least on my project, I'm working with a Corps of Engineers, and I've seen a real, like, desire on their part as well to help try to implement some of these optimization things, to try to look at how to incorporate these things into our design.
And I'll echo the contractors, I think, have a lot of great ideas. They've been very eager, and they're out front of us in a lot of ways. It's just we're uncomfortable, so, you know, again, part of our presentation, if to the extent that creativity may be used to undermine and argue against the statutory objectives and the protection of public health and the environment, we're not so excited and eager about that part, but most of the rest of it has been very positive and very creative.
Yeah, this is Kobe in headquarters. I would echo that comment, too. I think that they've been very, very useful and good. And they're right on top of it. If they're, especially if they're directed to do it, you know, they'll get right on it.
This is Mike Gill from Region 9. I just wanted to pitch in a little bit, too. You know, if you look at slides like, I think it was Kira's transportation and disposal slide. I don't see the number because it's darker than I can see in here. But a lot of these items are cost savers, and I think that's where we don't even need to tell the contractor to do that. They'll do it themselves, and I think that's a positive thing. So just kind of keep it in front of them that there are better ways to do things, and it will save them money as well. I think we were talking in here before when Kira was speaking, 4 out of 5 of these are just kind of no-brainers for saving money. So that that can lead people to doing things a little different way, too.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the phone lines. Are there any questions on the phone lines at this point? Okay, well, I'll go back to the simulcast, and we have another question. This one, not for Kira this time. This is for EPA Region 4. Pardon me? This is a general question, I believe. EPA Region 4 has not been represented in this webinar. Does that mean they are behind the curve in terms of green and sustainable remediation? Thoughts?
This is Mike Gill. That's not true. This is the third of 3 webinars. They were represented in earlier ones. And all 10 regions do have their own policies, and they pretty much mimic each other about saving resources and saving energy and doing things a smarter way. So, yes, they do follow green and sustainable remediation objectives, and no, they are not behind the curve.
And I believe... I can't remember if they were in one of the previous. We had 2 other sessions prior to this one, and the audio and presentations are available on the CLUIN website. So we can send you a link to that. And this question is for Vince. Regarding slide 88, cost of the C3 system, what are the O&M labor expenses, expense costs, other than utilities, for the C3 system? And that's from Hunter Sarton at ERM. Vince, are you still there?
Am I there now?
Oh yeah, you're there now.
Yeah, the system is expensive. Unfortunately, I can't provide the exact cost because of the federal contracting rules, but it provides a unique opportunity for expediting your cleanup system out there, but you do have to balance the cost of the system versus other treatment technologies. So, it's not one for low concentration systems. You do need a significant mass out there that you have to recover.
Okay, and I'm opening the floor back up to the phone line participants. Okay, I was going to go back to, this thing has updated on me and I've lost the question, unfortunately. There was a question for EPA Region 5, Brad Bradley's presentation. The individual wanted to know if there were any work groups available in EPA Region 5, I believe, for outside U.S. EPA employees to participate in. If so, what were they, and on any particular technologies? Brad, are you still there? Can anybody hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you, Suzanne.
Okay, I just started to think that my phone cut out on me or something. I guess we lost Brad?
Remind us of the mute and unmute.
Okay. To unmute, it's #6, and to mute is *6. So to unmute your line, just hit #6. Well, I guess Brad may have logged off. I'll forward that question on to him at a later time. And again, I'm opening up the lines, floor to the phone line participants. Any last questions?
Yeah, this is Region 10. This is Ravi Sanga. I'm an RTM from Region 10, and I have this question for Vin. How is that?
Can't hear you.
Hi, this is Ravi Sanga. I'm an RTM in Region 10, and I had a question for Vince on his presentation. How is your system considered greener? How is that remediation technology considered greener?
Well, it provides it's a little different approach from what you've typically seen on a lot of the green remediation documents, because it doesn't address directly power savings or some of the issues, but in this case, this is a resource or a materials conservation approach. So you're actually, instead of burning the material in a thermox unit or capturing the vapors through an activated carbon unit, which would then be shipped off for regeneration and recovery of the vapors that way. So that sidesteps both those issues and actually conserves the resource then for a beneficial use in a fuel recycling facility. So this presentation is a little different than probably the other ones that have been in the webinar series.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we've got a question from the simulcast, and I think this is up for the group. Have there been any ROD amendments initiated with state-funded O&M sites based on greener cleanup initiatives? If so, what regions or cases? And this is from a colleague over at Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Off the top of my head, I'm not aware.
Can you repeat the question again? Are the ROD amendments based on?
Have there been any ROD amendments initiated with state-funded operation and maintenance sites based on greener cleanup initiatives? If so, what regions or cases?
You know, Carlos might know that one, but I don't know the answer.
We'll park this and forward it on to Carlos Pachon, and hopefully he can provide us a...
Suzanne, this is Mike Gill. I might be able to shed a little light here. I would suggest that there isn't an amendment necessary if you're just going to do a greener cleanup, no matter if it's state or federal lead. When you have a ROD amendment, it's usually a technology change or a cleanup level change that forces that amendment. So if you're just going to do a greener cleanup, you don't need to take that huge of a step. That's just my thought.
Yeah, I would add to that too, Mike, that we were saying the same thing here in Region 10, and actually the whole concept of looking at optimization from the standpoint of making modifications to make remedies be more environmentally friendly is part of the current EPA optimization paradigm, where that is one of the components that we look at through that optimization process. So you wouldn't be changing a remedy based on trying to make something greener, so you wouldn't need you don't need a ROD amendment.
Uh, Okay, well, any more questions from our phone line participants?
This is Kirby. On that last question, I mean, while I do agree with the other two who spoke, Kira and Mike, and that is actually what I think we were saying in headquarters, is that, you know, since we're greening a cleanup that has been selected already, then it would not necessarily influence. But should we move even closer to the beginning of the process down to the RIFS level, I could see where, you know, some parsing out of the green remediation footprint might result in the selection of a different remedy for the rod than might have otherwise been anticipated. So I could envision a situation where that might come about. But not necessarily as a change post-rod, but as a change, as a pre-rod decision in the feasibility study that would actually select a greener cleanup over a, quote, greener cleanup over a, quote, less green cleanup.
Okay. Well, if there's no more questions, I'd like to just point your attention to the last two slides. One, slide 92, has my contact information on it, and I'd like to thank you again for all our speakers for giving us a very wonderful webinar. I learned a lot. I always learn a lot in these webinar series by Cluin. And we want to remind you that we're looking forward for specific responses to any of the issues that were discussed today. On slide 93, there is links on resources and feedback. So we'd like you to fill out the feedback form on what you thought of today's webinar and how we can improve it, what you like, what you didn't like. And also there's additional resources, and one of them, we've heard from people in the past that we use too many acronyms, so we tried to list most of the acronyms that were used in today's presentations. So with that, I'd like to thank you again, and we will call this session of the Green Remediation webinar over.